Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tell me how we got over. Lord, Lord, Lord. We had a mighty hard time coming on over. You know my soul looks like you wonder, how did I make it over?
Music from Mahalia Jackson to begin the Brian Lehrer Show today.
I can see Jesus, the man that died for me.
It is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, as you know now, no doubt know by now, and of Martin Luther King's iconic speech featuring I Have a Dream. Legend has it that Mahalia Jackson, standing behind King on stage, urged him to start his I Have a Dream riff when it wasn't in the original draft. We will analyze now some portions of the speech in the context of its times and why it stands out to this day. And we want to do some oral history today. We invite anyone who attended the March on Washington 50 years ago today to call in and tell us anything about your experience from that day or how it changed you and affected your life. If you were there, call us, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Add to our oral history archive. And joining us for this is history professor Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Tufts University Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and author of books including Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us for this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And let's get right to the first excerpt of the King speech. I'd like you to set up the context of this for us. This is the section right near the beginning where he works a theme of coming to Washington to cash a check and framing the Constitution and Declaration of Independence as part of a promissory note. What should we listen for? What's important to know as we hear this financial riff?
Well, the whole notion of the bad check is the most powerful metaphor of the entire speech. It's this notion that African-Americans have participated in American democracy, have fought all these wars to preserve and protect American democracy, but have never had the access and opportunity to benefit from the wealth, the employment, the jobs, citizenship within that democracy. So he says that he refuses to believe that the Bank of Justice is actually bankrupt in the United States. And the day of the March on Washington is a day where all Americans are coming to make sure that that check gets cast. So the check becomes a metaphor for the idea of citizenship and democracy.
All right. Martin Luther King, and I have a promissory note.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice.
That excerpt from Martin Luther King's dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom 50 years ago today. Tufts history professor Peniel Joseph is with us. Professor, with that transactional riff by Dr. King, maybe it's good to remember the full title of the march. It's not just the March on Washington. It's the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, not just for civil rights in a technical sense. Is that important to know?
Yeah, it's very, very important, because when we think about Martin Luther King Jr., sometimes we say, well, in the last 3 years of King's life, he switched to anti-poverty after the Watts Rebellion, after the Watts riots, and he started the Poor People's Campaign in 1968, and then he dies in Memphis, Tennessee, helping sanitation workers who are on strike. But really, as early as 63, he's talking about economic justice, and the march was really supported by labor activists. Bayard Rustin, who's the main organizer of the march, had strong ties to the American Labor Union. So there's all kinds of trade and machinists and different unions that are there. The idea that racial justice was linked to economic opportunity and economic equality was really the main thrust of the march. And A. Philip Randolph, who's really the grandfather of the entire March on Washington movement, he had started this movement in 1941, threatened FDR with 100,000 black men who were going to march in D.C. unless the military was desegregated. FDR delivers an executive order doing that, although it's not really going to be implemented until Truman is president. A. Philip Randolph was head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and he creates that union because the only job that black men could get that was a decent, high-paying job was in the Pullman car industry, the railroad industry. So, you know, A. Philip Randolph knew that citizenship was also about employment, a good paycheck, where African-Americans could take care of families, could take care of their children. So the march is really an extraordinary movement, because it's linking democracy not only to the idea of racial justice, but to the idea of economic opportunity.
So the bad check and the promissory note coming due. We'll do more speech analysis from the dream speech as we go. First, let's get to some of our oral history callers. We're inviting anyone who was at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom to call in and tell us anything about your experience from that day, or how it changed you or affected your life. If you were there, call us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Rudy in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rudy.
Good morning, Brian.
Were you there?
I was indeed, yes.
What do you remember?
Well, I so much remember the return trip home with a spirit and a feeling of optimism and uplift that kind of hadn't been realized again for me until Grant Park in 08 when Obama was on the open field. But the irony of that trip was that we were denied, as a busload of kids going back to Brooklyn, we were denied by Howard Johnson's restaurant a chance to eat or use the facilities.
Where?
In Maryland, on I-95 North, after a day of celebration and uplift and optimism, we were slapped back into a new reality, or in an old reality, and reminded very clearly that we still had a lot of wood to chop.
Professor Joseph,
service on I-95.
Professor Joseph, does that story surprise you, given that it was in Maryland north of the Mason-Dixon line?
No. What's interesting about Jim Crow is that Jim Crow was really a national phenomenon, or racial segregation. So sometimes people like to say that, you know, it was only a southern phenomenon, but all around border states like Maryland, parts of Pennsylvania, parts of upstate New York, people could easily relate to the story this gentleman is telling us, where you're denied access even though you're in a so-called, a state that is not a Jim Crow state. So it's not just Alabama, Mississippi. These are the states that are iconic states of racial segregation and white supremacy of the 1950s and 60s. But it is states like Maryland. It is states like Pennsylvania. It's states like Delaware, where people who are African-American were not provided equal access. So I think that's a heartbreaking story, but I think it's a genuine story of the struggles for democracy and the struggles for racial justice and economic justice that took place in this country 50 years ago.
Rudy, thank you so much for calling in. Sarah in Greenwich Village, you're on WNYC. You were at the march?
Yes, I was. Yes.
What do you remember?
Well, I was working for Mobilization for Youth in New York, and I took a group of youngsters, teenagers down, And I got to the march, and I ran into my mother, who had brought a group of children from the K Boys Club in Pittsburgh. And it was quite a reunion for us. And I went to school with Martin. I was at Spelman while he was at Morehouse, and we did go to one class. I went and had a class with him, which was the religion.
Appropriately. Do you remember anything of him from that class?
Well, I remember he was smart. He was smarter than I was. And he did know his... He knew the history because his father was the pastor of one of the biggest churches in Atlanta at
mm-hmm.
that time.
That's right. Sarah, thank you very much. We'll take more of your calls as we go. Let's play another excerpt from the dream speech. The dream wasn't the only metaphor Dr. King used that day. That's one of the recurring themes of this segment on our show right now. The dream wasn't the only metaphor Dr. King used that day. We heard the promissory note financial riff from the start of the speech. In the section that comes right after that, he talks about the need for immediate change, not gradual change. And you'll hear in this section the line that President Obama brought into the present for his, or the recent past, for his 2008 campaign, the fierce urgency of now. Professor Joseph, want to set up for us why in 1963 Dr. King emphasized the urgency of the present moment?
Yeah, absolutely. 1963 is extraordinary because right before the March on Washington, there's a flood of historic events. It's the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, but King gets his biggest civil rights victory in Birmingham in terms of aligning himself with the local leader, Fred Shuttlesworth, and desegregating public accommodations in Birmingham. But clergy and political officials had told King to wait and to stop mass demonstrations because they were being too disruptive. And in a letter from Birmingham jail in April of 63, he says that African Americans can't wait on democracy because if they do, it actually distorts and disfigures the entire nation. So by the time he's talking about fierce urgency of now on the March on Washington, John Kennedy had done his famous race speech on June 11th, 1963, where he talked about civil rights as a moral issue. Medgar Evers had been assassinated June 12th. And so there's a flood of events. So this idea of why we can't wait, there's literally hundreds of demonstrations that are happening in the United States that summer. Thousands of people are being arrested. So the fierce urgency of now, King is talking about, is really not only to promote African-American citizenship, but also to preserve and promote a flourishing democracy.
Dr. King, 4 minutes into the speech, still 7 minutes before he would even mention the dream.
We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning.
1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Martin Luther King from the Dream Speech 50 years ago today. At the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, Tufts history professor Peniel Joseph with us. I'm curious, Professor, in your book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, do you reference the fierce urgency of now and tie its use by King in 1963 to its use by Barack Obama in 2008?
Yes, I do. And Obama used that term, fierce urgency of now, very, very successfully in 2008. It gave him, it lent credibility to his campaign and his articulation that he was part of a Joshua generation, that King had been part of that Moses generation and that figure that led African Americans to see that promised land of racial freedom and justice. And he was part of a Joshua generation that had benefited from all that King had done. But there was a fierce urgency 45 years later in 2008 to right the old wrongs and to move the country further in terms of racial progress and economic justice. So he uses that very, very effectively in terms of as a campaign tactic. Now, King used it not to run for office, but to try to transform a nation and lead a social movement. So there's a difference between how these two gentlemen used it, but certainly Obama has used it effectively in 2008. But one thing I'll say, in 1963, when King is saying the fierce urgency of now, that summer of 63 is really the first summer of racial discontent. Some people will say it's 64 with Harlem and 65 with Watts, but Birmingham explodes in the summer of 63. So the first summer of national civil disorders is actually the summer of the March on Washington.
Ron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. You're at the march.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for all you do. Yes, I was at the march. I grew up in the Bronx with immigrant socialist parents who taught me all about racial equality. And then when I was 14, we took a trip down to Florida, and I saw firsthand what segregation looked like. But to be there at the age of 24 with my wife, I was, I guess the feeling I would say is I was proud to be white. To see so many white people among so many other people, because the feeling, the overwhelming feeling was that of defiance. And I was just thrilled to be there. I was standing about a football field away from the stage and seeing all my heroes like Pete and Joan Baez and Mahalia Jackson on stage. It was just such an overwhelmingly wonderful feeling.
Ron, thank you very much. And here's one of your heroes. Sneaking in right now. Joan Baez and Martin Luther King in the Dream Speech, and we'll play part of this passage, spoke to people like Ron, the white people in the crowd. We'll hear that. We'll talk more to history professor Peniel Joseph and hear more of your oral history of being at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom 50 years ago today. 212-433-WNYC. Len Chandler on guitar and vocal. Keep your eyes on the prize, being backed up by Joan Baez, Stuart Scharf, and somewhat unenthusiastically by Bob Dylan. Music from the stage at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom 50 years ago today. Let's play another excerpt from the Dream Speech, then we'll get back to more of your oral history calls, people who were there. Our lines are full right now, so if you're trying to get in to tell us your story, you'll have to wait till people finish up. But as we've said, the dream wasn't the only metaphor Dr. King used that day. We heard the promissory note financial riff from the start of the speech and his riff on the fierce urgency of now. We move next to a section that is as central to King's legacy as an American icon as anything he ever did, probably. The way he tied his militancy, and you'll hear him use that word, militancy, in this section, with his calls for nonviolence and, per our last caller before the break, to not distrust all white people. Dr. Joseph, want to set this up for us and our guest, Peniel Joseph Tufts, history professor, in terms of King's belief system or its rhetorical place?
No, absolutely. What King is trying to do here is King always believes in this idea of multiracial, multicultural democracy. And King is really the only leader during the civil rights movement's heroic period who could speak effectively, equally to black and white audiences. So King, in effect, serves as a defense attorney during the civil rights movement. He defends blacks to whites and whites to blacks. So he tells black people that white people, even if there might be mobs or they might be violent, not all white people are racist. They're brothers, and there has to be shared sacrifice to build this brotherhood. And he defends black people to white people. He says that black people only want to participate and be included in the society. They don't want violence. They don't want to somehow destroy neighborhoods or destroy the United States. So it's extraordinary in the way in which he is a bridge builder between the races. And his idea of democracy is really predicated on this notion of racial integration, but also nonviolence. Nonviolence for King is not just a strategy and tactic like it was for other civil rights leaders. It is a philosophy, and he imbibes that philosophy of pacifism. And really, it's both Christianity and pacifism that leads him to this belief that nonviolence can be something that cures America of its sickness of racism and injustice.
So here is Dr. King talking to, quote, my people about their responsibilities, not just their quest for their rights.
There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone.
Martin Luther King from the Dream Speech 50 years ago today at the March on Washington for Jobs on Freedom. He was a heck of a writer, Dr. Joseph. Marvelous new militancy. Who would come up with a phrase like that? How central do you think that passage was, that, you know, multiracial embrace, to making white people's hearts go pitter-patter over this particular speech and toward making it such an iconic speech? Because that was only 2 minutes out of a 17-minute speech.
Well, I think it was crucial because this is going to be the first time most Americans, including President John Kennedy, get a chance to hear King. So in effect, what the March on Washington does is some people have compared it to a national mass meeting. But it really jumpstarts a national conversation about race and democracy and this idea of inclusion, this idea of, you know, what's the place for white people? In the 60s, we used to talk about white guilt. King is not about white guilt at all. He's saying that blacks and whites are inextricably tied to the future of American democracy and that the only way forward is together. So King's notion of racial integration is actually a very, very militant one, because he doesn't define racial integration as sort of black people having to go to predominantly white schools or white neighborhoods. He defines it as blacks and whites building together the future of American democracy. So it's quite extraordinary. And this notion of marvelous militancy, what he's referring to is the hundreds of demonstrations that are going on in 1963, because people usually think of demonstrations and mass militancy as connected to the Black Power movement or the late 60s anti-war movement. John Kennedy talked about demonstrations and street protests in his televised address 2 months earlier. So both the president and King are acknowledging that, look, something's happening. Kennedy called it a revolution. And can you imagine a sitting American president saying there's a revolution happening in the United States? And he says it can be either peaceful or violent. And Kennedy is determined to make it peaceful. And that's what King is saying, too. He's saying that there's a revolution happening domestically. It's actually an extraordinary part of the speech. But he's saying it's a marvelous militancy, because King has always said that the greatness of America lies in the right to protest for right. Mm-hmm. So King acknowledges that America, what makes it so special and this democracy so special, is that people can protest, but he wants that protest to be nonviolent. And he's right, because the nonviolent protest is what's so revolutionary and transformative. Nonviolence transforms this country in the 1960s much more so than any threats of violence.
And pairing the words marvelous and militancy, marvelous is something that would, you know, generally invoke a smile, militancy, maybe a scowl on the part of those who are being militant for their cause. And so it's just such an unusual pairing that obviously had an impact. Well, we'll do more speech analysis from the Dream Speech as we go. First, let's get back to some of our oral history callers. We're inviting anyone who is at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom to call in and tell us anything about your experience from that day or how it changed you and affected your life. Our lines are full at the moment, 212-433-WNYC. William in East Orange, you're on the air. William, thanks for calling. You were at the march?
Yes, sir. I was with my great-uncle, who, according to my grandfather, was a pinko at Columbia University. I was 11 years old, and my great-uncle bribed us with all sorts of activities at the Smithsonian and so forth. But here's what's much more significant. Now, of course, it stayed within me and perhaps repressed into my unconscious, but I am now a history teacher and an old man in a black district, which is Haitian American, Jamaican American, African American. For 17 years, I've asked the following question and done a lesson. How could George Bush and Malcolm X both have significant respect for that speech? And the simple answer, of course, is George Bush read the last two paragraphs where we have breakfast together, and Malcolm X read the whole speech. And the students are quite appreciative. And interestingly, we're talking about 16, 17-year-olds. No one has got the answer, and, of course, no one has read the whole speech. So I find that to be a really good history lesson.
How about, William, how about the way that your Haitian immigrant kids and other black immigrant kids relate to this speech that doesn't come from their country of origins roots, but from their country of choice?
Well, if I cite people like Bob Marley, Toussaint Louverture, and so forth, and given that the Haitian American, Jamaican American kids have seen enough disgust in the country where the streets are paved with gold, they really don't have a problem with the criticism and the blank check and our parks are filthy and our classrooms are overcrowded. So, and of course they know his name, Dr. King, and I spend a lot of time, especially with, as the professor was saying before, the late Dr. King, who I would argue is a democratic socialist, in talking about imperialism, militarism, and economic exploitation all linked together. And in his 67 speech at Riverside Church, he talks a radical redistribution of economic power. So
they relate. And that was, yes, in his foreign policy phase, Vietnam, of course, in full swing, and he became an outspoken critic of the war. And, William, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for your memory and your reflections on how you use it today in class. And Sarah is calling in from Paris, France. Sarah, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Bonjour. I'm very, very happy to listen to this show. It's a lifeline for me to New York to listen to your show on streaming. I just wanted to say that I was between the end of secondary school and going to college. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, originally, but I had been in a Quaker boarding school. We demonstrated in front of the Pentagon near 62, 61 against atomic testing. I never had experienced the joy and the massive energy and the beauty of that March on Washington. I keep tearing up when I think about it. I took the commuter train down to Washington early that morning, surrounded by suits, all drinking their morning coffee in those blue cups they used to have before latte came along. Anyway, I got there and it was just a beautiful day. And it was seemed to me to be really mixed, black and white. I happen to be white myself. Everything was wonderful. All my heroes were there, as one of your former callers said. And I had never heard Mr. Randolph speak before. And although I can't remember what he said now, I remember he was eloquent and fabulously elegant and just a great orator. And then Dr. King topped it all, of course. But, you know, I would play the guitar and imitate Joan Baez, and there she was singing.
And did Dr. King top it all to your ears that day?
Well, yes, as I recall, maybe your guests can tell me if I'm mistaken, but I think he was the last speaker. And it was he? Yeah.
Was he, Dr. Joseph?
Yes, he was. He was the keynote.
Okay. Yes, that was. It was like it was the grand finale. And I had not personally experienced, although I'd seen it maybe in movies, the kind of response of people in a black church. But it was everybody, black and white, would be answering him and calling back and saying, "Oh yes," and "Yes, Lord." And it was that was very, very moving. But I want to second what your prior caller said about being a democratic socialist. And I wanted, in a very friendly way, to suggest to your guest, who seems to really know the subject very well and to be very erudite, that he's kind of tiptoeing around the expression social justice. And I think that social justice was very much on all our minds there for everyone.
Sarah, thank you. Thank you so, so much. And we're proud to be your lifeline to New York.
The thing that I just really wanted to say, that the forgotten man in all of this is Paul Robeson. That's all I wanted to say. Maybe your guest will elaborate on that.
Sarah, thank you. You want to pick it up, Professor?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, no, social justice is crucial here. I would argue that the speech is really a call for radical democracy. So sometimes people will say King becomes an anti-imperialist, anti-war activist only by 67, 68. Certainly he's brought into the anti-war movement by Stokely Carmichael and Stokely's really heroic struggle against the Vietnam War in 66. But King is talking about radical democracy earlier than that. So certainly King is a democratic socialist. King is a social justice advocate. But the March on Washington is about radical democracy. Two people we can talk about briefly, Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois. Du Bois, founder of the NAACP, heroic struggler for racial justice, dies in Ghana. And then the announcement is made the day of the march, right at the march. Roy Wilkins makes that announcement. So there's a real symmetry there. Du Bois lives from 1868 to 1963. And without W.E.B. Du Bois, there is no Martin Luther King Jr. There is no March on Washington. He's the person who struggled against Booker T. Washington and struggled for civil rights and anti-lynching legislation, along with people like Ida B. Wells in the late 19th, early 20th century. When we think about Robeson, Robeson is another heroic figure who, because he is a communist and a Marxist, is really marginalized. In the 1930s and 40s, Robeson is one of the most popular Americans in the United States and the world. He's a singer. He is an actor.
He is somebody who is from the Harlem Renaissance and continues to be a struggler for social justice. He mentors Harry Belafonte. He mentors Lorraine Hansberry. He mentors many, many activists, Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, who go on to be social justice advocates. So Robeson is somebody who is marginalized because of the Cold War. But without Paul Robeson, something like the March on Washington could not have occurred.
And we'll get back to your calls in a few minutes. But in the dream speech, Dr. King made one reference to New York. It comes at the end of a riff on the question, when will you be satisfied? Dr. Joseph, want to set up for us the context of this question, when will you be satisfied, and why he comes to reference voting in New York right next to voting in Jim Crow, Mississippi?
Yeah, when he talks about when will you be satisfied, he's really talking about, again, continuing that riff on the fierce urgency of now and really now policy, what needs to happen to really have citizenship rights be claimed by all African Americans. And the reference in New York is the fact that voting rights is not 100% anywhere in the United States in 1963. So even though there's states like New York State, Illinois, New Jersey, where African Americans have more access to the ballot, they still don't have 100% access to the ballot. So he understands and makes this reference that Jim Crow is a national problem. So in a place like Alabama and Mississippi, the numbers are so low that it's outrageous. But in a place like New York State, there's still going to be restrictions depending upon where one looks. So he's really articulating this notion that Jim Crow is a national problem and not just something that is occurring in the South.
And so here is Dr. King, about a minute worth. Listen for the New York reference at the end of this section.
There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote.
Martin Luther King from the Dream Speech 50 years ago today at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Tufts History Professor Peniel Joseph with us. What did he mean by those specific words about New York? We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. When he says nothing for which to vote, what does he have in mind?
Well, I think he's talking about access. He's talking about places like Harlem, which in Harlem has Adam Clayton Powell Jr., but where there's really no representative democracy for African Americans who are in New York. Who is speaking to issues beyond Congressman Adam Clayton Powell of racial justice, of poverty, of slum clearance? He's talking about the fact that there's really no chance for, even in a place like New York City, for blacks to wield major political power, even though Jim Crow in New York does not resemble Jim Crow in Mississippi in the exact same way. The outcome is very, very similar in terms of this lack of power, this powerlessness, poverty. So really segregation, but the segregation in New York is de facto instead of de jure. Everybody is locked up in tenements and in housing that's deplorable in places like Harlem or parts of Brooklyn, parts of the Bronx that are strictly racially segregated, but it's not segregation in the same manner as Mississippi and Alabama, but the result is very similar.
And things were beginning to change in New York at that time. Constance Baker Motley, black woman, was Manhattan Borough president. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. was in office as the first black congressman ever from New York. Just the beginnings of change, but they were beginning by 1963. By the way, a correction on something I said before when I said Maryland, when we were talking about that state, is south of the Mason-Dixon – is north of the Mason-Dixon line. It's actually south of the Mason-Dixon line from the slavery era. Am I correct? But the it just wasn't a Jim Crow state in 1963. Correct, Professor?
Yes.
Okay. So we straightened that out. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Tufts History Professor Peniel Joseph. We'll continue in a minute with more from the I Have a Dream speech in historical context and more oral history from you if you were at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. 212-433-WNYC.
How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died?
The answer, my
Some Blowing in the Wind from Peter, Paul, and Mary from the stage at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom 50 years ago today, as we continue to listen to Martin Luther King's speech excerpts as well as some of these music clips. We have one more of the music clips from the stage to go in a few minutes and one more speech excerpt and more of your calls, your oral history, contributions. If you were at the march 50 years ago today, Jin Nolly in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can. You were at the speech, at the march?
I was actually there. I heard you play an excerpt where King referred to white sisters and brothers and who were there, and my then-husband and I were two of that group. Two of the things that impressed me the most, I think, were on the one hand, the combination of the size, the black and white integration, and the unbelievable harmony of the crowd. It's impossible to describe what it feels like to feel safe and comfortable in a crowd of 250,000 people, which, of course, I didn't know was the number at the time. The other thing that impressed me very much was I had left my husband because we were very close to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and I wanted to get closer, so I ran up onto the steps of the memorial, which, unlike Saturday's demonstration, it was possible then to do. So I was on the steps during the entire program of that demonstration, and being there, I was able to look back on the reflecting pool, as is sometimes seen in films which are shown today of that event, and see the reflecting pool and all the way back to the Washington Monument with people just as far as the eye could see. I mean, there was no visible end to the crowd. It was just overwhelming. And, of course, the people could sit at the edges of the pool, and they were, you know, dangling their feet in the water. It was actually indescribable. I don't think I have the words to describe the experience.
So you've done a great job of describing part of it. Very moving description. Jin Nolly, thank you very much. And John in Plainfield, you're on WNYC. You were at the march?
Yes, I was. I had just graduated from high school and getting ready to go to college in the fall, Rutgers. I went down with my church, Mount Hermon AME in Elizabeth. There was some trepidation because Mega Evers had been killed in June, and there were some other things that were going on in the South and coming down from the North. We really didn't know what to expect. We got down there kind of early. We were one of the first down there. And so there weren't that many people down there, so we didn't know if anyone was coming. But then the buses started to roll in, and a group of core people, they started getting off their bus, and they all were wearing dungaree overalls, you know, with the shoulder straps. They were kind of dressed like farmers and everything, and they were really unified, and they made quite an impression because they were one of the first groups that started to roll in. On the way back, you know, there was it was a great event, of course, the number of people. But on the way back, there was kind of relief that it was such a great event and an exhilaration, you know. And I've been active locally in community action ever since.
You really thought you might be alone, just you and your traveling companions and the speakers on the stage.
Well, when we got down there, there weren't too many other folks down there, so we didn't know whether it was going to be our bus and a few others or the hundreds of thousands that eventually it became to be.
Thank you very much for your call. All right, one final clip from the MLK speech, and it is the dream sequence. Professor Joseph, this doesn't come until 11 minutes into the 16-minute speech, lest anyone think that's what the whole speech was. We talked last week on the show with historian Taylor Branch about how it wasn't in his draft speech for Washington, even though he had been using the dream riff in some other speeches around the country, and he decided with the speech in progress to go to that refrain. For time purposes, give us just 30 seconds on this, but why was that? Did he not think the speech was going well, or why else would he call an audible and switch it up like that?
Well, I think he later says that something just moved him. So the legend is Mahalia Jackson says, tell him about the dream. But I think King had spoke to 200 people, 200 different speeches a year, at least for many, many years. And I think what he did in the I Have a Dream portion is really try to do a capstone and a summation. So he goes into his preacherly cadences there. So King was somebody who had historically been very, very aware of his education and sort of projecting a kind of erudition. And in here, he just taps into the Black church tradition and just lets loose.
Martin Luther King, 50 years ago today.
Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racist, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood.
Martin Luther King, 50 years ago today. We thank for the great context provided this hour history professor Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Tufts University Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and author of books including Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor, thank you so very much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
And we go out with some final music from the stage, from the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom.
Fishes will laugh as they swim out of the path, and the seagulls.